September 2nd, 2016 was a normal Friday afternoon for 13-year-old Lauren Landovazo. It was a scorching hot Texas day, but it was the start of a three-day weekend for McNeil Junior High School in Wichita Falls, where Lauren and her friends were eighth graders. School let out around 3:05 that afternoon, and Lauren gathered her belongings, including her purple binder, to take home for the weekend. She left school with a group of friends to walk home like she did every day, using a pedestrian access road people in Wichita Falls called the Alley. It wasn't a narrow, dark alley like you'd see in some cities, but a wide gravel path that connected the school to the nearby neighborhoods. Hundreds of kids used it every day to get home, and it wasn't long before Lauren's friend, Michaela Smith, spotted her up ahead and asked her to wait up. Lauren obliged because Michaela was one of her best friends, but they didn't have any classes with each other that year. The girls had gotten close through cheerleading and walked home together frequently, catching up about school, friends, and boys. The girls giggled like normal teenage girls and talked about how sad they were to not share any classes this year. A few minutes later, Lauren and Michaela reached the end of the alley, where it emptied out into a suburban neighborhood on Trinidad Drive. They usually parted ways here, and that day, Michaela planned to walk home, and Lauren was walking over to her boyfriend Donovan's house to hang out. As the girls prepared to go their separate directions, an SUV pulled up next to the sidewalk, blocking the entrance to the alley. The SUV stopped and the girls paused, thinking the vehicle was picking up one of the students they were walking with. It wasn't unusual for parents to drive to the alley to fetch their children, instead of waiting in the long pickup lines at school. But this vehicle was different. The man in the driver's seat of the truck methodically pulled out a rifle and opened fire at the two girls. Michaela felt the bullets hit her chest, and she screamed at her friend to get away. Shaking and bloodied, Michaela turned to look for Lauren, but could only see her legs lying on the ground. She screamed for her friend, but Lauren didn't respond. Over the chaos of the shooting, Michaela's phone rang. It was her mother. She answered and choked out, "Mommy, I was shot." A bystander who had called 911 saw that Michaela was alive and began administering life-saving aid to the 13-year-old girl. Minutes later, Bianca Landovazo, Lauren's mother, arrived at the scene. She had heard something from a neighbor about a shooting at the alley and had run down the street to see what happened. Driving behind her was her husband, Vern Landovazo, who had jumped in his truck to follow his wife. Lauren lay clutching her bullet-riddled binder to her chest. Bianca saw her on the ground and let out a piercing scream. Who in the world could have done this? This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, Episode 112. Michaela and Lauren were rushed to the local hospital for treatment. Medics knew that Lauren's condition was close to hopeless, but attempted to resuscitate her. She had no heartbeat, wasn't breathing, and in addition to numerous gunshot wounds, she had suffered a traumatic head injury when she fell to the pavement. At the hospital, the Smith and Landovazo families met for the first time and prayed for their daughters' lives in the waiting room. They had no information about what happened to their girls, other than they had been shot on their way home from school and needed critical medical attention. Michaela had been shot 3 times, but survived with surprisingly minimal injuries. Lauren, however, had died almost instantly from multiple gunshot wounds. An autopsy would later reveal that Lauren had been shot 14 times by her killer. Her injuries, doctors said, were so extensive they were physically impossible to recover from. While the families were at the hospital, Wichita Falls police had busied themselves securing the scene, gathering evidence, and beginning their search for Lauren's killer. The biggest question weighing on the minds of investigators as they spoke with witnesses and combed the scene was who would have shot at two little girls? What motive could there possibly have been to kill Lauren? The SUV the killer was driving had left the scene and was long gone by the time officers arrived. But fortunately, there were numerous eyewitness accounts of what had happened. Some were fellow middle schoolers who had been walking home in close proximity to Michaela and Lauren, and some were parents driving their own kids home who happened to see the aftermath of the shooting. From the eyewitness accounts, police were able to build a description of the killer. Michaela and the other teenagers who had seen him described the suspect as a white male of thin build with long, dark hair. He had some acne, they said, and was driving a gold SUV, possibly a Chevy Tahoe. Other witnesses said they had also seen a black SUV at the scene, prompting police to put out a description for both vehicles in their search for Lauren's killer. Despite the description of the perpetrator, police had very few clues to go on. From the crime scene, investigators were able to deduce that Lauren had been shot with a .22 caliber rifle, but there wasn't a lot of other evidence. There was no DNA left behind because her killer had remained in his car the whole time, and nobody at the scene recognized the suspect. As news of Lauren's death spread through Wichita Falls, mourners set up a memorial for her at the entrance to the alley. Purple ribbons and signs honored Lauren, who was remembered by her friends and family as lively, funny, and kind to everyone. Friends said she was the type of person who always wanted to help and who had a positive outlook on life. Joanne Perez Ramirez, a lifelong Wichita Falls resident, didn't know Lauren, but she had seen the news coverage of Lauren's murder and heard the radio reports describing the suspect. She didn't really want to go visit Lauren's memorial, but her boyfriend at the time, Faustino, wanted to go look. So on September 4th, the Sunday after Lauren's death, they drove over to pay their respects. The memorial was a sea of purple, Lauren's favorite color. When Joanne and her boyfriend arrived, there were people there crying, and they decided not to get out of the truck so they could let the mourners grieve. They pulled over to the side of the road to see if the crowd would clear out in a few minutes. They also had their eyes open to see if the SUV that police were looking for would happen to be there. And they were shocked to see a gold-colored SUV drive by.
Because while we were waiting, Faustino, you know, we just said, well, look out for a vehicle, you know, just make sure we don't see a vehicle going by. And we saw a vehicle drive by us that was the description of the SUV.
Okay, what did you see? What was the vehicle that you thought looked like the vehicle that everybody was looking for?
It was a gold SUV. Okay. With a young white male driving it.
The driver was a young white male with dark hair. Immediately, Joanne's mind flashed to the news reports she had seen. But instead of calling the police on someone who might be innocent, they decided to follow the SUV. The SUV turned right into an apartment complex close to the memorial. Joanne and her boyfriend followed and parked where they could see the suspect and his vehicle. The driver got out of the truck. He had shaggy, dark hair and was wearing a baseball cap, a white t-shirt, black shorts, and running shoes. He went around the back of the SUV, and Joanne noticed for the first time that the truck was a Chevy Tahoe. The driver went to his back passenger door and took a long, skinny object that looked like a rifle out of the back seat. He stuck the butt of the gun under his arm and held it close to his body. Then he put a blanket over it, looked around the parking lot, and hurried into an apartment. To Joanne, it looked like he was hiding something. She called 911 and said they had possibly seen the guy police were looking for in connection to Lauren's murder.
He's a tall, skinny white boy with shaggy, shoulder-length hair, and he had a hat on with glasses. And it took him a while to get out of the back seat. He was standing there to get something out. And it was a long something wrapped up in blankets and clothes.
Okay. You said it was a rifle, or you just thought it might have been a rifle?
It was the way he was holding it. It looked like it was. Because he was trying to hurry up, and it was kind of like he was suspicious.
Joanne wrote down the truck's license plate number on her hand to give to police and was shocked to see she had grabbed a purple pen. Thanks to Joanne's instincts, police were able to pull over the Chevy Tahoe when it left the apartment complex a few minutes later. The driver turned out to be 20-year-old Wichita Falls resident Cody Lott. He lived at the apartment complex near the crime scene with his mother and stepfather. Cody consented to a search of his car and was then immediately taken into custody when officers found 22 rifle shell casings on the floor that matched the description of the bullets used to kill Lauren. That same day, Cody Lott was charged with one count of murder for killing Lauren and one count of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon for shooting Michaela. In interviews with police, Cody confessed to killing Lauren, saying he had planned the shooting with the devil. Cody Lott was held on $1 million bail at the Wichita County Jail. He faced the possibility of life in prison if a jury found him guilty of Lauren's murder. Nothing about getting Cody to trial was easy. In March 2018, before his trial was scheduled to begin, he was found incompetent to stand trial. A psychiatrist's evaluation found that he lacked a rational or factual understanding of the nature of the proceedings against him, and he would be unable to work with his lawyers to make sure he got the best defense. Cody had a history of mental illness, as well as drug and substance abuse. According to psychiatric records, he had started using marijuana and opioids when he was 12 or 13 years old to cope with his parents' divorce. He had struggled with anxiety and depression, as well as schizoaffective disorders in his young adult life. He had gone to treatment programs for his issues, but often left them early or blew off check-ins. After 6 months of treatment at North Texas State Hospital, Cody was found to be stable enough to face a jury for Lauren's murder, and his trial began in September 2018. The trial had been moved from Wichita County to Tarrant County because of concerns that trying him in Wichita Falls would be unfair. After all, Lauren's murder had been a highly publicized incident, and it would be difficult to find jurors who hadn't been exposed to the media coverage or who didn't have a preconceived idea of what had happened. Cody was represented by a team of public defenders, while state's attorney Maureen Shelton prosecuted the case with help from special prosecutor Ron Poole.
And this case is about sweet, vibrant, joyful Lauren Landavaza. She was 13 years old. She's the daughter of Vern and Bianca Landavaza.
Shelton described how Cody had watched Lauren for months before the shooting. He saw the girls that day, she said, and drove over to the alley to ambush them. Shelton promised the jury they'd hear from numerous witnesses to the shooting, as well as parents and neighbors who responded to the scene after hearing the telltale pops of gunfire. Garrett, a 14-year-old from Wichita Falls who was 12 at the time of the shooting, was called to the witness stand first. He had just started sixth grade at McNeil Junior High School and normally walked home from school with his best friend Luke. Luke wasn't there that day, so Garrett said on this occasion he walked home alone. As he approached the end of the alley, he saw a gold-colored Chevy Tahoe drive up. He only noticed the truck because his dad, a police officer in town, drove the same kind of vehicle, and it was often parked in their driveway. The car stopped, he said, and he saw a weapon come out of the window. He couldn't remember what happened next, but he heard screams and then gunshots. Garrett told Shelton that he knew who Lauren Landavaza was, but that they weren't friends. He had seen her in the hallway at school and noticed her blue eyes. After the gunshots, he saw Lauren fall and ran to his neighbor's house nearby, knocking on the door to get help. Three other McNeil Junior High School students testified after Garrett. One of the most compelling testimonies came from a girl named Hope, who was also 12 years old at the time of the shooting. Hope said she normally walked home after school too, and was walking with five friends that day. Lauren and Michaela, along with two others, were ahead of Hope and her group in the alley. Like Garrett, Hope saw the gold SUV pull up at the entrance of the alley. At first, like the other kids, She thought Lauren and Michaela were getting picked up by one of their parents, but she soon saw something was very wrong. After the shooting, Hope heard a lot of commotion and saw Lauren fall to the ground. She saw Michaela run towards Lauren, but didn't see what happened next because she was focused on herding her friends into the safety of her backyard, which was nearby. Hope said the whole shooting felt like a dream and didn't seem real. Once her friends were inside her house, Hope, though she was shaking badly, went to check on Michaela and saw she wasn't okay. She yelled at her friend Elijah to call 911 because her phone wasn't working at the time. Though Hope was uninjured and didn't know Lauren well, the shooting had a lasting traumatic impact on her life. She said she went to therapy for 2 years to cope with what she had witnessed. Michaela, who was 15 by the time the trial began, was calm but emotional when prosecutor Maureen Shelton called her to testify. Her childlike voice wobbled as she recounted the terror of the day. Cody sat next to his attorney watching her, his fingers clasped together, resting on his chest. Michaela was asked if she was ever scared to walk home, and she said no. She described Lauren as very kind and open-minded. She was very positive about everything, she said. After school let out that day, Michaela told Shelton that she met up with another friend and started her usual walk home from school. She spotted Lauren across a field and caught up with her friend so they could catch up on their walk home. As they approached the end of the alley, they saw an SUV pull up and block the exit. Again, no one thought this was unusual because it was a popular location for parents to pick kids up and take them home. Michaela said she made eye contact with the white male sitting in the driver's seat before he pulled out a gun, pointed it at them, and pulled the trigger. She couldn't breathe, she told Shelton, and felt blood pouring from her body. She yelled at her friends to get away and began to cry. Michaela testified that she sat down because she knew she'd collapse if she kept standing. While she was sitting, her mom called her, and Michaela told her that she had been shot. She saw Lauren's mom arrive and heard her scream. As emergency medical services worked to save Michaela's life, she said she prayed that her friend would live. I was asking questions. I was asking if Lauren was okay. I was getting mad, but I was being cooperative, she said. They put me on the gurney and they were rolling me out to the ambulance. She then described seeing her friend with a white sheet over her. After Michaela's emotional testimony, Shelton called John Lewis to the stand. John was a retired Army engineer and had lived in Wichita Falls since 2011 with his wife and kids. Lewis was outside his house near the alley, cleaning up some coffee cups he had left in the backyard. And as he opened the door to go back inside, he heard gunshots from what sounded like an automatic rifle. He said it sounded like a .22 rifle. Lewis described how the first shot was a solo event, followed by numerous rapid-fire shots. He told Shelton his military training kicked in when the shots fired off in quick succession, and he jumped into action. His daughter Paige was a student at the same middle school as the others, and normally walked down the alley with the other kids, but Lewis had just bought a bike for her birthday, and she had taken the paved roads instead. Lewis said he scaled the 6-foot fence around his property and ran into the alley. He hit the ground so hard, he said, that his flip-flops fell off and he didn't notice. He did notice, however, two vehicles leaving the scene, a champagne-colored SUV and a black SUV behind it. Both sped off quickly, he said. He described what he saw when he came across Lauren.
When I approached Lauren, I noticed, it's hard.
I know, let's take your time.
I noticed that in what we refer to in the Army, and also the infantry, as the death glaze or the death stare. Mm-hmm. Just to stare off into nothing. It was just...
And what does that mean when you say the death stare?
When a person's deceased, and there's no movement, and their eyes stop, and there's no movement. They just kind of stick where they're at. That's what I call the glaze, where they don't move anymore. They just stop.
Is that what you saw?
That's exactly. That's what I saw with Lauren.
He then saw Michaela and ran over to her. He laid her down and called out to his daughter to get him something so he could put pressure on her wounds. "You're a champ," he recalled telling Michaela. "You're going to be fine." He said she was a trooper. Another lady came and started taking care of Michaela. He said all hell was breaking loose at that point. Tons of people and kids were now there, crying. He said the neighborhood was quiet and family-oriented. The schools were close and a big selling point for families moving to the area. Nothing like the shooting had ever happened before. Lewis said his family was so affected by the shooting and its aftermath that they're currently planning on moving to another town.
Mr. Lewis, are you moving?
Yes.
And why are you moving?
A good majority of it. Well, I say a big chunk of it is, it's a constant reminder when I leave the house, take the trash out, mow the yard, of what happened on that day. The chaos, the death. It's a constant reminder for me and my family. And that's a good reason why we're leaving.
At Wichita Falls Hospital, Dr. Fred Langer was one of the general surgeons working that day. Dr. Langer said that Lauren was a candidate for emergency drastic treatment. However, it soon became apparent that her wounds were so severe that there was no way she could have survived. All that was left to do was to tell her family the bad news. Michaela was wounded on the right side of her chest, Dr. Langer said, but the injury was not life-threatening and did not require any intervention other than standard treatment for a gunshot wound. The last people to testify on the first day of the trial were two law enforcement officers whose testimony would complete the picture of what happened that day. Officer Dale Finnegan of the Wichita Falls Police Department told the jury that he was working the afternoon of the shooting and patrolling the area near Midwestern State University, which was close to the town's elementary schools. At the scene, Finnegan's main role was speaking with witnesses and directing them to detectives for further questioning. It was very chaotic, he said. A lot of people were screaming and yelling. They were on their phones trying to get a hold of their families, and a sense of hysteria permeated the area. Finnegan said he was at the scene for 6 hours and recorded a lot of what happened on his dash cam. Some of those highlights were shown to the jury during his testimony. In one heartbreaking moment, the jury could hear a woman screaming, "That's my daughter." Finnegan identified the voice as Lauren's mother's. Finnegan testified that police originally called for people to look for a black pickup truck, the truck witnesses believed to have seen leaving after Lauren was murdered. "The scene was really confusing," Finnegan said. And later, police collected witness statements that said the truck was not actually black, but gold-colored. The second day of Cody's trial largely focused on the events that happened after the fatal shooting. Dr. Emily Ogden, the medical examiner, performed Lauren's autopsy at the request of the Wichita Falls Police. She testified that Lauren died at about 4 p.m. on September 2, 2016, from more than 10 gunshot wounds. The jury was shown photos of Lauren's blood-stained clothing and jewelry. As the photos were shown to the court, Dr. Ogden explained that Lauren was shot in both hands, spine, shoulders, chest, liver, as well as twice in the head. She had cuts and bruises to her face from when she fell to the ground, she said. The shot that likely killed Lauren was the one that hit her where the brain meets the spinal cord in the back of the head. But other shots were fatal too, she said, including the bullet that Lauren took to her liver and left lung. After the graphic testimony about Lauren's autopsy, crime scene technician Hillary Avilar testified. She had been the one who photographed Lauren's body and Michaela's injuries to document them for the court. She had also been tasked with collecting their personal belongings as evidence. Tears began to flow in the courtroom, and a box of tissues was passed around when a picture was shown of Lauren's blood-covered ring. Avilar said she removed it from the girl's right hand. Photos of a heart-shaped charm and key on a chain were also shown to the jury. The technician said she had removed the chain from Lauren's neck. The little details showed how brutal the shooting had been. It also painted a picture for the jury of how young Lauren was. She was so young, she still wore her house key around her neck every day. Following Avilar's testimony, Joanne Ramirez testified and described for the jury how she and her boyfriend had tipped police off to Cody Lott and triggered his arrest. After she described following Cody's car to the apartment complex and calling police when she saw him exit the car carrying what looked like a concealed rifle, Joanne was cross-examined. Cody's defense attorneys had not been relying on cross-examination very much during the trial, often not questioning the state's witnesses at all. But attorney James Rasmussen did have a few questions for Joanne.
Ms. Ramirez, with all the news coverage, I imagine you wanted to help.
Yes, sir.
And that's why you called the police?
Yes.
But you didn't witness any of the shots fired on September 2nd?
No, sir.
And you don't know Cody except from that? You don't know Cody Law?
No, sir.
And you don't know about his mental state on September 2nd, 2016?
No.
Wichita Falls police officer John Gordon was driving near Cody's apartment when the call came in from dispatch about a suspicious person. He drove to the north entrance of the Fountain Gate apartment complex and then received word that the suspect's car had left and was traveling down Barnett Road. Officer Gordon headed in the direction of the suspect's vehicle and came across it within a minute or two. Once he had confirmed the license plate number with dispatch, he activated his emergency lights and pulled the driver over. Cody pulled over into a shopping center, he said. Officer Gordon approached the driver's side window, identified himself, got Cody's license and insurance, and explained to him why he was being stopped. He said the vehicle had been reported as suspicious at Fountain Gate and that it matched the description of the vehicle near where Lauren had been killed.
When you approached the driver, did you notice anything unusual about him, or nervous or casual?
He had both hands on top of the part of the steering wheel, and he had it grasped hard enough that the right forearm was actually shaking.
Appeared to be somewhat tense.
And nervous.
Nervous,
sir?
Yes, sir. Tense and nervous.
When he asked if he had any weapons in the car, Cody said no and suggested the officer search it. The prosecutor asked Officer Gordon if it appeared that Cody was in control during the traffic stop.
Did he appear to respond to your questions appropriately?
Yes.
Did he relate details about where he had been and even why he had been at his parents' house over there at Fountain Gate?
Yes.
Did he appear to be responding to any kind of hallucinations or delusions, anything of that nature?
No, sir.
Did he tell you he was hearing boys?
No, sir.
Both the prosecution and the defense argued over whether to admit Officer Gordon's dash cam footage into evidence. The judge ultimately ruled in the prosecution's favor, and the jurors were shown the video the next day. The video shows Officer Gordon driving down Barnett Road with Cody's gold Chevy Tahoe in front of him. Once Cody pulls over, Officer Gordon slowly approaches the vehicle and says a cheery, "How are you doing?" "Good, sir," Cody responds. During the traffic stop, Cody tells the officer he lives at Fountain Gate, and Officer Gordon says he understands and just needs to check everything out. Cody then tells the officer he's just driving to his dad's house across town to take care of his dogs. Cody was arrested by Officer Gordon after officers found a shell casing in his car that matched the bullets used to kill Lauren. April Kendrick, a firearms expert, testified that that shell casing found in Cody's car came from a gun that officers later found in the apartment Cody lived in with his mom and stepfather. An audiovisual enhancement expert testified on the third day of the trial and showed the jury video of Cody in the backseat of a police cruiser following his arrest. In the video, Cody appears to make some incriminating statements and also appears to be praying for forgiveness. Sammy Reisner, who worked at a marketing agency and did professional video enhancing, said Cody could be heard praying to Jesus on the video. I heard, "Please, Jesus, help me. Please, Jesus, forgive me. Please forgive me in the name of Jesus," Reisner testified. Now, this evidence could be damning for Cody because it showed awareness that he committed a crime. If his defense team was relying on an insanity defense, they would need to prove that he didn't know that killing Lauren was wrong because he had a severe mental illness. But prosecutors weren't done. They then called the captain of the Wichita Falls jail, Lisa Patterson, to the stand. Patterson manages and maintains the records of inmate phone calls, use of force reports, and handles other day-to-day business at the jail. She told the jury that a third-party provider records and transcribes inmate phone calls. The transcriptions are then kept as records at the jail, where Patterson has access to them. Inmates are aware that all their phone calls are monitored. When they pick up the receiver, an automated message tells them as much. Nonetheless, Patterson said Cody had a very candid conversation when he called his mother and stepfather from the jail on September 4th, 2016. Cody tells his stepfather that he was arrested for the murder of that girl. The audio is a little difficult to hear, so I'll recap afterwards.
Did y'all hear about what happened after I went to go get the money that she had to pay for the reasoning?
No.
Well, I mean, I was arrested on the murder of that girl and the shooting that happened.
And did you do it?
Did you do it? I confessed it, yeah.
Did you do it?
Yeah, I did it.
Why?
I don't know.
Did you do it or did you just confess it?
I did it.
You did it. How'd you do that?
I just did it, man. I don't know.
In that clip, you can hear his mom and stepfather ask him if he did it. He replies, "I confessed to it, yeah." "Did you do it or did you just confess to it?" his stepfather asks. "I did it," Cody says. When his stepfather asks him why, he says, "I just did it, man. I don't know." Cody then says he wants to talk to his mom. His stepfather says she's right here, that they're in the car together. "Then let her talk," Cody says.
"What?"
"All right, that's all. I just want to let y'all know. Yeah, so. That's it.
Okay, so, I mean, you just messed up your whole life, so."
"Yeah, well, regarding that stuff."
"Okay, well, I mean, have fun in jail and stuff and for the rest of your life now."
"Well, have fun not letting you ask for money all the time. So you can now focus on your money. See where that
is." "Really?"
"I just wanted to let y'all know, so that's it," he tells his mom. When she tells him he just messed up his whole life, he says, "Yeah, well, it was already messed up, so." She tells him to have fun in jail for the rest of his life now. He replies, telling her to have fun asking for money and focusing on her money now. They then say goodbye to each other. While his jailhouse confession may have been enough to prove that Cody was in fact the shooter, the recording of his interview with police was equally incriminating. Detective Alan Killingsworth testified that he interviewed Cody after he was arrested on September 4th. The jury was shown 3 hours of that interview. The video showed Cody slumped against a wall in the police precinct, wearing the same white t-shirt and dark shorts that Joanne Ramirez had described to the police earlier in the day. In the interview, Cody tells Detective Killingsworth that he lives in nearby Seymour, Texas with his grandmother and does not have a job or go to school. He claims he was in Olney, Texas, 45 miles away from Wichita Falls at the time Lauren was killed. Detective Killingsworth testified that he eventually steered the conversation towards the shooting. At the time, he said Cody did not appear to be suffering from delusions or hallucinations and that he seemed fairly normal. "Whoever did this needs some help," Detective Killingsworth says during the interview. I'm talking about some serious psychological help. Cody agrees and then tries pinning the killing on a friend. But eventually, he confesses and tells Detective Killingsworth that he had been watching Lauren for months. "Something charged me up and I just jumped in my car and unloaded on them," he says. Cody tells Detective Killingsworth that he drove down the street towards the alley with his rifle loaded with 30 rounds. He says he fired at the girls until all the bullets were gone. Cody says Lauren smirked at him like it was all a joke before he shot her. He says he only had planned on shooting Lauren, but shot Michaela too. "It felt like a video game," he says. Cody was surprised that police didn't apprehend him immediately. He tells Detective Killingsworth that he lit up a joint on his way home and tossed the gun in a field, planning to retrieve it at a later time when it was safe. When Detective Killingsworth presses Cody on why he had killed Lauren, Cody says the devil had told him to and that he wanted Lauren to become an angel. He says he believed that if he killed her, that she'd be protected from the bad in the world and become an angel. The prosecution rested their case. The defense had deferred their opening statements until the start of their case. While the prosecution's opening statement encouraged the jury to think of the tragedy of Lauren's death, the defense's opening statement urged the jury to think objectively, without emotion. This wasn't a case to be decided by whether the jury felt bad for the victims, the defense attorney argued. It was instead a case about mental health. David Bost, one of Cody Lott's public defenders, said they would be proving that Cody was not guilty by reason of insanity. "Don't let bias, sympathy, or other such emotions cloud your decision," Bost told the jury. The defense only called one witness to the stand, Dr. Brian Falls, a psychiatrist. Dr. Falls testified that he examined Cody twice and reviewed many of his medical and psychiatric records. He also read the police report detailing the investigation and the interviews done by the Wichita Falls Police Department. During Dr. Falls's testimony, a picture of Cody's life and personality came into sharp focus. Cody had a long history of drug abuse, Dr. Falls said, and had begun smoking marijuana when he was 12 or 13 years old, to cope with his parents' acrimonious divorce. He quickly graduated to harder drugs like opioids and methamphetamines and regularly used prescription drugs, LSD and ecstasy. Drugs were a big part of his life, Dr. Falls testified. He was questioned about whether Cody's drug use was a result of an existing mental illness or if the substance abuse at such a young age had resulted in mental health issues. "In this case, we can't determine what came first, the chicken or the egg, in terms of his psychosis or drug use," Dr. Falls said. "Drug use at a young age increases the likelihood that a young person will cause schizoaffective disorder and psychosis. But such illness can also prompt people to use drugs." Cody's problems hadn't gone ignored or untreated, Dr. Falls said. In fact, Cody had gone to rehab several times and had been admitted and discharged from the University of Texas Harris County Psychiatric Center just before the shooting. While he was being treated at the psychiatric center, Dr. Falls said Cody was diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder. He confirmed that diagnosis and testified that Cody has a serious mental illness. Dr. Falls explained to the court that people with a major psychotic illness lose touch with reality. They hear voices that aren't there or feel things that aren't there. They can't form coherent sentences and struggle with disorganized and random thoughts. Dr. Falls said they suffer from delusions and believe in things that most healthy people wouldn't believe. For example, Dr. Falls said individuals with this disorder can believe they're Superman or Jesus. Quote, "Mr. Lott had delusions. He had beliefs that other people don't hold and are false. He had hallucinations. I also saw prominent disordered thought. He was rambling a lot when I saw him, going off on tangents, and his train of thought was very difficult to follow." Cody's defense attorney asked if Cody was able to remember the events of the shooting. He recounted them to me fairly accurately, Dr. Fall said. Did he explain to you why he shot these girls? The attorney asked. He had a lot of reasons, Dr. Falls responded. In addition to believing that he was working with the devil and actually saving Lauren, Cody also gave other reasons for killing her. He told Dr. Falls he had problems with females. He hated women and was jealous of Lauren and her boyfriend. He said he killed her to assert his manhood and for the thrill of it. Cody told Dr. Falls he was surprised by the outcome of the shooting because he thought Lauren wouldn't actually die. He said he thought he'd also be rewarded with marijuana, a big house, and all the alone time he could ever want. He believed that God was helping him get away with the murder, Dr. Falls told the court. He said he thought the Wichita Falls football game that afternoon would cause confusion and conceal what he was doing. When police didn't catch him for a few days, he said he was sure a higher power was assisting him. All of these beliefs, Dr. Falls said, were signs that he was suffering from delusions and could have been delusional prior to and during the fatal shooting. Dr. Falls was asked if he believed Cody was insane at the time of the shooting. It's my opinion that Mr. Lott did not know the wrongfulness of his conduct, Dr. Falls responded. On cross-examination, Prosecutor Maureen Shelton pressed Dr. Falls further on the reasons Cody said he had committed the killing. He wanted to see how it felt to take someone away from someone, Dr. Falls testified. He said he did it to get attention from the community and said he sure got the birds chirping. He said he did it to emulate serial killers like Charles Manson and Richard Ramirez. Shelton asked Dr. Falls whether Cody had expressed anything that signified he knew that what he was doing was wrong. Yes or no, did he ever indicate that murdering Lauren Landovazo was worth going to prison? Shelton asked. Yes, Dr. Falls responded.
The defendant did not mention the devil or act like he was suffering from a delusion during the first several minutes of his statement to the police on September 4th of 2016 when he was lying to them, did he?
No.
When the defendant, when asked by his mom and stepdad why he did it in a telephone call that was recorded on September 4th of 2016, he didn't say the devil made him do it or that he was hearing voices and the voices told him to kill Lauren, did he?
He did not within the first minutes, no.
He never did during that initial call, did he?
Oh, I'm sorry, we're talking about the call now. No.
To your knowledge, did the defendant's parents ever indicate to you or anyone that the defendant mentioned the devil or satanic research that he had completed around them or they talked about it around them at all?
His parents didn't have any knowledge of that. No.
And just because I research Christianity or the Bible, it doesn't make me Jesus Christ or God, does it?
No.
Nor does it excuse my behavior if I do kill in the name of God, does it?
No.
Shelton asked Dr. Falls if Cody had planned the shooting or if it had been a random spur-of-the-moment event.
So let's go before the offense. The defendant formed a plan, correct?
Yes.
The defendant watched the victim for a year, Lauren. He watched her walk home from school.
Yes.
He waited until his parents were out of town so he could get the loaded semi-automatic rifle from your apartment.
Yes, that's true.
He chose what type of semi-automatic rifle to use to commit the murder.
That's correct.
He chose the .22 rifle so that he wouldn't mutilate Lauren from using the .223, correct?
That's correct. That was part of his sacrifice.
Cody had gone to his parents' house and used a screwdriver to break into the gun safe. Dr. Falls said he had even left his parents a note saying he'd done the crime because he believed he'd be caught and wanted to explain it to them. Shelton asked Dr. Falls if the preparation for the murder was an indication that he was mentally sound at the time of the shooting. She pointed out that he testified that Cody had put the safety on the gun in an effort to prevent accidental shooting while he drove to the alley. After the shooting, he had discarded the weapon in a field so he wouldn't get caught with it. She asked whether the fact that Cody used words like murder when he spoke with Dr. Falls showed that he was aware he had committed a crime. Dr. Falls said that wasn't necessarily an indication he knew that what he was doing was wrong. After Dr. Falls' testimony, the prosecution called their rebuttal witness. Dr. Randall Price also consulted Cody's records, police files, and psychiatric treatment history before evaluating him. Dr. Price said he believed at the time of the shooting that Cody was likely suffering from a severe mental disease or defect, but that it did not prevent him from knowing that his conduct was wrong. This was important for the prosecution, because in order to be found not guilty by reason of insanity, Texas law requires that a defendant not know their conduct was wrong due to a severe mental illness. Dr. Price said he interviewed Cody on August 15, 2018, while he was being held at the Wichita Falls jail. He noted that Cody's hair was shoulder length, but his hygiene and grooming seemed good. He wasn't showing a lot of emotion and seemed flat at times. Other times, he smiled or laughed, which was rather inappropriate given the context, Dr. Price said. Since his incarceration, Cody had exhibited symptoms of depression, Dr. Price told the court. Cody told him he had a long history of suffering from anxiety, especially around other people. Cody also told Dr. Price that he had auditory hallucinations or heard voices in his head. He said the voices told him the day before the crime to, quote, enjoy murder, it'll be worth it. He did not hear voices on the actual day of Lauren's murder, though. Dr. Price did several personality assessments on Cody to dig deeper. One test suggested that Cody portrayed himself in a negative or pathological manner, or in other words, he exaggerated what was wrong with him. It made Dr. Price skeptical about just how mentally ill Cody might actually be. Dr. Price said diagnosing Cody was difficult for him, but he said he doesn't have a lot of disagreement with the diagnostic formulation presented by Dr. Falls.
As I've said before, he has a history of drug and substance abuse that's almost always difficult to disentangle between a mental disorder that's not drug-related.
As for Cody's drug use, Dr. Price said that his heavy reliance on marijuana and opioids may have induced a break with reality. But his behaviors when trying to cover up the crime, tossing the gun, lying low for a few days, writing his parents a note, were evidence that he was sane at the time of the crime and that he knew his actions were wrong. Cody told Dr. Price that he had planned the shooting for at least 2 months and timed it to happen while his parents were out of town.
He told me this was planned, that it was not an impulsive offense, that he planned it and thought about it for at least 2 months. And again, he was really concerned about his legal status at the time and thought he was going to go to prison, and said that he thought if he's going to go to prison, he might as well go to prison for something that was worth it. And that was a part of the motivation for this offense.
Dr. Price was the last expert to testify during the trial. And in addition to all the other witnesses, his testimony likely gave the jury a lot to think about. Was Cody aware that what he was doing was wrong? Or was he delusional, believing a murder would solve his problems? But it only took the jury 18 minutes to come back with their decision. Cody was guilty on all charges. During the penalty phase of the trial, Lauren and Michaela's parents took to the stand to testify about their loved ones. Shamika Smith, Michaela's mom, testified first. She wore a purple ribbon on her sweater in honor of Lauren and spoke in a soft voice that was often difficult to hear. Shamika recalled the events of September 2, 2016 in vivid detail for the jury, describing when she talked to Michaela on the phone, with Michaela screaming and saying she had been shot. I prayed to God to let her keep screaming, because if she stopped, I knew she'd be gone, she said. Michaela ultimately survived, but was forever changed. She needs to talk to her friends every day because she's afraid she might miss a chance to say I love you if they die unexpectedly. Shamika told Prosecutor Shelton that people often tell her she's the lucky one because Michaela survived. But she doesn't feel lucky. She has to cope every day with a child who has suffered from unspeakable violence, she said. Like Shamika, Vern Lendevazo was emotional as he delivered his testimony about Lauren. Vern has two sons from his first marriage, who he says he loves dearly, but he had always wanted a little girl. Lauren was a bit of a surprise for Vern and Bianca, he said, as she was born after they had been married for 13 years. Lauren was exceptionally kind, he said. He had never heard her say a single mean thing, and she was always helping people who were struggling. She had a theatrical flair, he said, and often put on outrageous outfits and makeup to make her parents laugh. She'd perform on the fireplace's hearth and sing along to kids' bop CDs to entertain them. The last time Vern saw Lauren was the night of September 1st, the day before she was killed. He hugged and kissed her goodnight. He was off work the next morning and didn't get up early to see her off to school that day. Instead, he took advantage of the free time to sleep in, and then busied himself doing yard work so he wouldn't have to do it over the weekend when Lauren was home. When Lauren was murdered in the alley, Vern was taking a break to eat some lunch and rest. He heard a commotion outside and something about the kids being down. Bianca said something and ran out of the house, he said. He thought maybe a kid had been hit by a car, so he jumped into his truck and drove. Worried that Lauren was somehow involved, he called her cell phone. When someone picked up, all Vern could hear was screaming. He got out of the truck, walked over to the corner, and saw her body in the alley. At his sentencing, Cody was given a life sentence for Lauren's murder and 20 years in prison for the assault on Michaela, as well as $20,000 in fines. However, despite the life sentence, Cody would be eligible for parole in 2048, according to Texas state law. While the news of his conviction was some sort of justice for Lauren and Michaela's families, it was worrisome that they might see Cody walking free in 30 years. And so Lauren's parents channeled their grief into lobbying the Texas legislature to pass Lauren's Law, which would toughen penalties for those convicted of killing children. Under Lauren's Law, prosecutors can charge a defendant with capital murder if the victim is younger than 15 years old. A capital murder conviction comes with a sentence of life in prison without parole or the death penalty. Previously, Texas law only allowed for prosecutors to charge defendants with capital murder if the victim was 10 years old or younger. He got the maximum he could get, Vern Lendevazo told the Times Record newspaper after the law was passed. This is for future families. If somebody is ever in our shoes again, we've addressed a situation in the law that has a hole in it, we think. Lauren's Law was signed by Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who is from Wichita Falls, and went into effect on September 1st, 2019, almost 3 years to the day after Lauren was killed. And that's all for today's episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think about this case. Was Cody Lott in control when he killed Lauren, or was he suffering from delusions like his attorney said? Do you agree with his sentencing? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, finding me on Twitter at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. This episode was researched and written by Kathleen McWilliams. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.